Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Now, a 2020 media manipulation survey by the Oxford Internet Institute had identified Malaysia as one of 81 countries with disinformation being produced at what they called an industrial scale by governments, by political parties, and by the PR firms they hire. Now, propaganda has long gone hand in hand with politics, but as election season approaches, everything gets intensified, including online disinformation. So to what extent do these homegrown disinformation operations pose a threat to Malaysian democracy? And as participants of the Information Society, do we understand how cyber troopers work to influence online public discourse? So joining me on the show tonight to discuss this further, I have Dr. Benjamin Low. He is the lead project investigator in an EU-commissioned study on the impact of interference in digital public sphere discourses in Malaysia. Benjamin, thank you for joining me. I'm hoping you can begin by first telling us a little bit about this study and what you had hoped to zero in on through your research.
Thank you very much, Melissa. Thank you for having me on today. So this study was actually the genesis of this study came about at the end of 2020, and we've sort of like been working on it. And the idea here is that for most Malaysians, if you ask the average Malaysian, if you mention the term cyber trooper, most Malaysians would be quite familiar with that term. But in terms of what they actually do, that's something that we in academia have not really done a lot of research on this. While there have been some mentions or different studies that have been done over the years, there's not really been any sort of like baseline study that has been conducted in Malaysia specifically to look at how cyber troopers have sort of influenced our local digital public spaces, especially. When I talk about digital public spaces, I'm talking about sort of like our social media spaces, our online news comment areas, and also our online forums as well. And this is actually quite surprising because cyber troopers is a term that actually originated from Malaysia. So, and we were one of the first countries that actually developed these so-called clandestine attempts to sort of like influence or the term that academics like to use is what we call astroturfing. This idea of trying to manipulate the way that public opinion appears online by creating these multiple accounts, which are fake, to give the illusion that there is more or stronger support towards certain political agendas and issues, essentially. So that was the baseline. That was sort of like the starting point of how we wanted to start this report. And then we collected all this information. And once we were done with the mapping, we then tried to sort of like suggest or recommend ways to trying to alleviate the issues with cyber troopers. And that's going to be a very, very big problem to tackle. But I'll talk more about that later on.
Yes, it is. I definitely agree. It's a big topic to tackle, but I'm glad that you brought up understanding how cyber troopers work. Then you can kind of map out the influence on digital public discourse. So let's talk a little bit about this astroturfing. How do cyber troopers typically work to, as you said, to kind of, you know, garner support or manufacture support that is more amplified than what it is in reality?
All right, so cyber troopers come in generally three shapes. So the first two are the ones that most people are familiar with, is what we call low engagement cyber troopers and high engagement cyber troopers. So low engagement cyber troopers are basically what people refer to as bots. Their role basically is just to spread information, distribute it, and whenever any sort of like article or any post that supports their views or is against their views comes up, their role is to just flood that entire site with either positive or negative engagement. So you either do mass liking, mass hate, or post a lot of negative comments and things like that. Very, very, it's focusing more on quantity rather than quality. So the idea here is that you give the illusion that, oh, I see this politician has made a post and there's 50,000 likes on it. So when people look at it, they think, oh, there are at least 50,000 people who support this politician. So that's the general idea behind what low engagement cyber troopers are supposed to do. So high engagement cyber troopers are a little bit more sophisticated. So these are essentially people who will basically behave as online trolls. Their goal is to go into online discussion spaces and essentially disrupt that entire space. They would either behave in a very aggressive manner. They attack people who present positions that are opposing to what they are trying to defend. And they would often engage in a lot of strategies such as online harassment, attacking people, and really just making it a very hostile environment for public debate, essentially.
Right. Ben, can I ask you, cyber troopers, is that a real person on the other side of the screen, on the other side of that keyboard? Is that a real person?
Yeah, see, that's another big question. And that's really the third type of cyber trooper that we found. That often, more often when people think about cyber troopers, they think, oh, these are people who are paid to, they are paid to do this as a day job. You know, they're giving us a amount of money to make these posts in a day. But for the most part, in the last few years, we're starting to see a lot of people who actually have adopted these so-called, they use the same techniques and strategies as cyber troopers, but they are ostensibly real people. These are people with real profile accounts and whatnot, but they have just taken on very, very sort of like aggressive approaches towards their political stance. And in Malaysia, people tend to call these groups of people, the local colloquial term is machai, but in academia, we call it political diehards, essentially. So it's actually become very complicated in the last few years as a result of that, you know.
Right. That's quite interesting. I'm just wondering, okay, so that's how cyber troopers operate. And the idea is to influence public discourse. Do they actually do that? I mean, do disinformants like cyber troopers, like trolls and all that, macha if you want to call it, do they impact the way people think and the way people behave? Does it have a material impact in that respect, Ben?
I would say that the easiest way that we can see this is simply because that Malaysia has become, again, we're a country that has been dealing with cyber troopers for a very, very long time. In countries like America, for them, it's probably only happened in like the last 7 to 10 years. But for us, it's been closer to 20 years, essentially. And the biggest problem that we're seeing with that is that whenever it comes to, when people look at discussions that are happening online, they will, it comes to the point whereby, due to the fact that we've surrounded ourselves with echo chambers through social media and whatnot, when people see any viewpoint that is so glaringly different than what they expect, that challenges their own sort of like preconceived notions, people will, the first instinct that people tend to have is to just sort of dismiss that and say, that's a cyber trooper, that is basically paid content, it's all fake, it's all disinformation. And that has really poisoned political debate in this country as a result of that. Now, we don't have any actual data to measure a lot of these things, but if you just look at Facebook, in our study, we identified Facebook as really the highest bed of activity for cyber trooper content. And you can see, whenever you look at a lot of this sort of like politician-based sort of like posts that you have, that you'll see they tend to have tons of, like, there's tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of comments, reactions and whatnot. And many of these are very obviously from cyber trooper accounts. These are accounts that don't even have a profile picture. They use generic names. They don't even bother to put friends lists and things like that. It's very obviously fake. And when people try to, and most of the comments will be very positive and supportive. And when you see any negative comment, you will see a lot of these high engagement cyber troopers coming in and attacking them and basically making it seem as though these people are the cyber troopers themselves. And also making it so that it's a hostile environment that people who do want to present other viewpoints will not be persuaded to continue posting that as well. So they basically annihilated the whole idea of debate in these online spaces.
Yeah, coming back to that interesting phrase you used, poisoned political debate in Malaysia, does that mean that we have just stopped, or don't know how to disagree with one another properly, that you know, we dismiss any kind of opposing view as paid disinformation? How that must be quite detrimental to, that's how you see it pose a threat to democracy. And how do you go about correcting something as fundamental as the ability to disagree with someone you don't agree with?
Disagree
respectfully, I would say.
I mean, that's really the big issue that we're facing, you know. So, I mean, we've now been in the social media era for almost 2 decades now, about 15 years now at this point. And the thing about social media, right, is that we as a society have been trained to reject anything that we see as toxic, as negative, that doesn't agree with what our ideals are. You know, the whole idea is that you should curate your social media feeds and only put in things that you like, follow content creators that create content that makes you happy, and remove anything that brings negativity into your life, gives you toxic...
You don't agree with that?
Oh, no. I completely agree with that. It's just that when that sort of thinking is applied to political discourse, it has a really horrible effect, because with political discourse, you have to expose yourselves to various different viewpoints, because even if you do want to if you do have a very strong political ideology or you support a certain political stance, it's important to also understand what the other side is thinking, what their values are as well, because it's impossible to have a healthy debate to understand, to defend your position if you don't actually know what the other side is presenting as a counterpoint, because you never know whether your position is actually valid or you've just been in your own little echo chamber, your own silo, and you don't actually know that there's actually more that fits within your own ideologies that you just never realized it as well.
Right. So kind of part of the maturing digital information societies, we have to learn how to take opposing viewpoints. Benjamin, can you talk to me a little bit about media literacy and where this fits in? A lot of the onus falls on the user to be media literate to the tactics of a cyber trooper. But if the information system is so polluted, if it's so poisoned, then why is the onus on the user then to see through all this noise?
Well, the main issue essentially is that we are now at a point where there is no such thing as a standardized media trust. Different people, depending on which context you're from, what circles you have exposed to, what social networks that you have, will have different trust in different types of media. So, it's always understood that in Malaysia, people from urban areas are going to be more trusting of online media, whereas people in more rural parts of the country have more trusting towards state broadcasters, essentially. And as a result of that, it's very difficult to find any sort of media that is seen as being objectively correct or factual, that crosses all sort of like the political divide, essentially. And so we've come to the point, and social media has also sort of given this illusion that people are agentic. People can make rational decisions on their own. They don't need the media anymore anyway. But of course, the social media itself is governed by algorithms and AI, and that in itself shoehorns people into certain holes that they may not realize. So it's very, very important that until we find a way to sort of like legislate or control that area to avoid all of these issues, these pitfalls, that media literacy is the way to protect people in that sense. But the problem that we found that with this study and why we're proposing a new way of looking at media literacy is that media literacy often assumes that people are 100% rational. People will always be wanting to do all these things. And the thing is, the idea here is that if you are actually media literate, you probably would not be in an echo chamber anyway. But being fully media literate is incredibly tiring. You know, imagine if every time you see a piece of information that comes in from WhatsApp or from your Instagram feeds and whatnot, and you do the entire gamut of media literacy checks, you know, you do fact checking, you check multiple sites, you ask experts. That's incredibly tiring and really not sustainable for the average person who just wants to know, who should I vote for, basically. It's very, very difficult. So what we are proposing instead, and again, for some people, a lot of people are probably in echo chambers and don't realize it. And it's very difficult to sort of approach them and tell them that, oh, you're in an echo chamber, you've been led astray, because it's very difficult for people to come to terms with that and accept that they haven't actually been in control with their media, but the media was controlling them. So what we're proposing is to get people to introduce the idea that as part of your media literacy diet, you don't have to do the full checks and everything like that, because we know that's too tiring, too onerous, but instead, develop a kind of like a sort of like a reflection system, like a media diet. Think of it as, yes, you've got all this content that you really like, but try to also include some content that is, in terms of politics, very, very opposing to what you naturally view. And that will allow you to at least be exposed to different viewpoints. And you never know, and at least that allows you to develop sort of like a stronger viewpoint that, oh, I'm informed about what the other side is thinking, and therefore I can form a more coherent argument as to why I support my side as well. So that's what we're kind of proposing. We haven't actually tested this yet. So hopefully if we can get enough funding to run the second phase of this study, we can actually do that portion, and that will be something that's a lot more effective at tackling the situation.
Well, definitely looking forward to seeing if this develops further. An interesting topic indeed, and a very timely one. Benjamin, thank you so much for speaking with me today. Dr. Benjamin Low, project lead of an EU commissioned report on cyber troopers in Malaysia. We're going to take a quick break, but more on this topic in just a couple of minutes. Stay tuned. Hi, welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. Let's continue our conversation about the impact of cyber troopers and cyber trooper interference in the digital public Sphere Discourses. Joining me now is Haris Zainal. He's a senior analyst at the think tank ISIS Malaysia, where his research focuses on mis and disinformation and the policy responses to it. Haris, thank you for joining me today. To what extent do you agree with claims that cyber troopers and cyber troop operations in Malaysia pose a threat to our democracy? I mean, I'm just wondering how much can such operations influence public discourse online?
Sure. Thanks for the question, and also thanks for having me. With regards to the statement that you just mentioned, I do agree quite generally with that claim, and I'll illustrate with a few examples. Right, we know that cyber troopers are able to divert attention away from pressing issues during elections, such as items in a manifesto, etc., and divert it towards issues that, you know, that they can manufacture that is not so productive during the election period. Because, you know, let's be fair, we're spending a lot of money to have the elections. Mm. You know, they can also engage in smear campaigns against their political opponents, which, if the information at the basis of that smear campaign is true, then that's not necessarily a problem in and of itself, because it's part and parcel of politics. But if that smear campaign is based on lies, if it's based on disinformation, then that can be very problematic. Besides that, we also know that influence operations can also artificially inflate engagement rates of certain topics, making them seem to be resonating more among the Malaysian public when it's actually not the case. And, you know, taken together, all this can really skew and influence the discourse, the online discourse, among Malaysians in the lead up to the elections.
Do you think, Haris, that this is just something we will have to accept in terms of our political landscape? Will we just have to accept political interference in our digital information societies just going forward?
I don't think it's yes and no, right? As with most things in life, like on one hand, it's the inherent nature of the internet, social media, modern day politics, etc. But on the other hand, it's not like we should just sit on our hands and just twiddle our thumbs and not do anything about
it. But are you seeing much political will? There doesn't seem to be political will coming from any side or any of the sides to address this.
Yeah, I think that's fair, because most of the political parties, they are engaged in campaigning on social media. That's, again, it's the 21st century kind of politics, utilizing every kind of medium, you know, possible to engage the voters. So I don't think it's a problem inherently. It is just part and parcel of today's political landscape. But again, it will only be a problem if the cyber troopers, the people who are paid to be promoting content, are pushing out disinformation.
All right. Do you think there is a role then for a securitized approach, you know, more legislation or regulation, police intervention? Would any of those things help?
If it comes to authorities, personally, I don't think so. I'm very hesitant to recommend, a state-centric approach. You know, legislations, policy interventions, all that, you know, it can start off as something that's well-intended. Mm. But, you know, when rubber hits the road, it's going to be very hard to implement. For example, if you want to regulate the usage of cyber troopers, right? Who is going to determine if a person posting a piece of political content is being paid to do so or not? Are we going to, you know, investigate every person who is going to be, you know, pushing up political content? Because we push up political content on our social media platforms at all times, right? It is not practical, I think.
Okay, what about the platforms? Can, you know, the Twitters and Metas and other platforms, what can they do? Should they do anything? Should they do more?
Platforms definitely have a role in this, right? And I'm really happy that you brought this up, because it's one of those aspects that's been absent from most of the conversations held on this topic in Malaysia so far. Because we cannot and we should not avoid the issue that, you know, the fact that this issue is taking place on their platforms. In terms of what we can do or what we can get them to do is to, you know, really be ensuring that the coordinated misinformation campaigns, the coordinated influence campaigns, they are mitigated. And you can mitigate this by really enforcing the community standards and removing accounts that breach the inauthentic behavioral community rule, really enforce that as best as possible, and also try to increase transparency in terms of who is doing what on their platforms.
Right. How would they do that? Increase transparency? I know, for instance, the Philippines government, which had to deal with a lot of disinformation in their recent elections, they tried to implement some kind of legislation or some kind of regulation about having SIM cards being approved before you can, having SIM card numbers before you can actually register for a social social media account. Might something like that work for Malaysia, or do you think that could have unintended consequences for that?
For one, I think we already need to register our IC number when we get a SIM card. If I'm not mistaken, the last time I got a SIM card was many, many years ago. But
right.
There will definitely be unintended consequences, right? For example, in the region.
To tie that yeah. into your social media account.
Oh yeah, for sure. If you look at the region, right? Most countries in the Southeast Asian region, we are not the most democratic, and there's no use in tiptoeing around this very fact. What happens if human rights defender on social media is made to register his or her national identity card number to a social media account? Sure, there's transparency, there's accountability and all that. But at the same time, maybe that's not what is needed right now in the region, considering the wider environment of how we do clamp down on dissent, we do clamp down on critics of certain regimes. So in unintended consequences is what we really need to try to avoid, I think.
Okay. Well, we're in election season now. Do you think that GE15 is mainly going to be fought on in the digital public sphere? And if so, Harris, what advice do you have for social media users in the lead up to GE15?
I do think that everything's going to be fought in the digital sphere from now onwards. I don't even look at it as the digital sphere anymore. It's just merged. Everything is just one. But, when this is the case, right, there's going to be a lot of things that people really need to be aware of. And the first is that not all information are created equally. All Facebook posts look the same, all Twitter posts look the same. Yeah, sure, aesthetically they look the same, right? But they are not created equally. Some information are more accurate than others, and some sources of information are more credible than others. And that applies to both mainstream media and social media accounts. The second tying that in is to consume, if it's news that we're talking about, consume news from credible sources. I think that's really important for people. And the third is to really read, if it's about opinions, read as widely as possible. The world is not black or white, as some people would like us to think. Most of the times it's somewhere in between. So read as widely as possible, even if it's opinions that we might not necessarily agree with, so that we know all sides to an issue before making up our minds on who to vote.
Wonderful. Harris, thank you so much for joining me on the show. Harris Zainal from ISIS Malaysia, wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching, and good night.